welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust, and we've been broadcasting every week since. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 these days, every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Bristol campaign against high-rises with journalist Matthew Montagu Pollock, who's been kicking above his weight and getting a lot of people interested in the very relaxed planning policies of Mayor Marvin Rees. Also, we speak to Richie Allen, who's a rare rogue talk show host. He's Irish, but he broadcasts from Manchester. And also to Alexander Azadgan, a professor from California. And here today, he'll be talking about 9/11, as well as something called Pan-Arabism, the idea that Egypt, Syria and other Arab countries could all be working together. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street, and I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Matthew Montagu Pollock, and I've lived in Bristol for 7 years. I'm by background a journalist, and I've lived in Asia for 23 years before this and come back to Bristol, which wasn't my hometown. If I have a hometown in England, it's London probably. And I landed this kind of Rip Van Winkle figure after a quarter of a century in Asia, and looked around me and saw Bristol and didn't understand how the UK worked, didn't understand anything about the place. But 7 years later, it's a different story. And I've been interested in Bristol's beauty, Bristol, the civic society in Bristol, Bristol's what's happening to Bristol. And about 4 months ago, I suddenly realized that everything was going to change and that the new administration in the City Hall had plans for Bristol which involved essentially covering the center of the city with tower blocks. And I was shocked because this is a very special city. It's very beautiful. It has pockets of ugliness resulting from the bombing and resulting from mistaken policies in the 50s and 60s and later. But with proper planning and proper additions, it could be wonderful. And a lot of the stuff that's been done recently has been very good. For instance, look around the harbour, jail, whatever they're called, steps. Those buildings, which are about six floors, are very attractive. They're all new. They are what modern urbanists think is a good thing. They're dense buildings, a lot of people in the centre. This is a good thing because it allows public transport, it allows people to walk and cycle to work, and this is what we want because on the whole we want to head towards reducing car use. And so this is a European style city in the style of the cities that we go on holidays to see on the continent, cities like Munich, Toulouse, Lyon, Vienna even, which are Paris, which are dense cities, basically 19th century cities, with no high-rise in the centre and a very rich urban experience of walking, sitting at cafes, watching other people.
Now, you're from Asia. Mm. I mean, I'm thinking about cities like Kuala Lumpur and Hong Kong, massive amounts of high-rise buildings, Singapore.
Yeah.
Now, those are just Asian examples, but can you think of any European examples of the sort of city you don't want to see here?
Well, I would say Leeds. But I have to admit that I haven't spent a long time in Leeds. But arriving at the station and looking around the, in my eyes, catastrophic mixture of sort of random high-rises with historic stuff just all jumbled together.
Now, there's a massive temptation to build high, isn't there? Yeah. If you're going to buy a piece of land, the more stories you can put on it, the more money you can make.
the more money you can make. And this is part of the point of this whole exercise.
But the planners are there to moderate that, aren't they?
They are, but the planners are very much in defensive mode with a new administration. One gets, I don't want to make a party political point, but one does get the feeling that Marvin Rees is kind of in a bunker of secrecy. Everything goes through the mayor's office, and nobody much knows what's going on, even within his own Labour Party, even Labour councillors. And the push towards high-rise very much comes from Marvin himself.
I mean, just as an example of that, we've had the report commissioned into Bristol's libraries, but the report is remaining secret.
Oh, really?
And only site that the senior people in the various other parties are allowed to see it, the Conservatives and the Lib Dems, is with an officer staring over their shoulder to make sure they're not photographing anything in the report. So I think you're probably right about the bunker mentality, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's a very sad thing. And what gets me, in a way, about all this is if Marvin had wanted to completely transform the city, because this is really the biggest thing which is going to happen to Bristol in 100 years. We are changing from one of these marvellous continental cities which we pay money to go and see in our holidays to something very different. Modern high-rise cities kind of look the same wherever you are. If he'd wanted to do that, why didn't he put it in his manifesto? Why didn't he go out and consult? Now, under George, there was an extensive period of consultation between 2015 and 2017 on the future of the city. Should we lose our green belt or extend ourselves into the green belt? Should we build on the outskirts or should we build in the centre? And people understood that you had to build more in the centre because you want to get away from a totally car-centred city. But there was no mention of high-rises in all this. And then suddenly comes in the new administration and the same document, which is called Urban Living, the Urban Living Supplementary Planning Document, is suddenly full of pictures of high rises and instructions that we should build high rises. And still no consultation. The only two consultations which were held, if you look at the documents of who was invited, it is 85% building industry and developers.
Now, I wonder, I mean, this might be cynical of me, but whether this is simply a plan the developers have cooked up that Marvin Rees is just nodding along to.
Well, of course, if you want a heck of a lot of stuff to happen very quickly and you want your numbers to announce at the next election, what you do is you let the free market rule and you accept whatever any developer comes along with. And that's basically what Marvin has done. But this is not how cities should be planned. This is not how you build a beautiful city. What you do is you plan, what is done on the continent in these cities is you plan in advance, you put in the public transport, you put in the trams, you put in the cycling, you put in the green, you limit the height. I mean, Freiburg, where urbanists all sort of go on to see the best planning in Europe, has a height limit of 5 floors. And it manages still to expand. It's got quite a constricted natural geography. It manages to expand. The densest cities, if you want densities, the densest cities in Europe are Paris, which is not high-rise, Barcelona, which is not high-rise, and the densest borough in the UK is the borough of Kensington and Chelsea, which is certainly not high-rise. There are a few high-rise buildings in it. So you don't need to go high to build densely. You do have to be a bit more clever with an existing city to densify it. But there's no need to go for high-rise. And I mean, I can talk about why, apart from the aesthetics of it changing the city, we're going to end up with a completely different city. Apart from the aesthetics, there are social reasons which are very important. People are, on the whole, less happy in high-rise buildings.
Are they? I mean, you know, actually, sometimes people will say, actually, there's a nice view here.
Sometimes people say it's a nice view.
You know, if you can, all you can see is the building on the opposite side of the road and you've got a high rise that you're looking out of your house at, surely actually having a decent view for maybe a couple of miles from your bedroom window, from your living room window, is better.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but there's a lot of work to show that high-rises tend to be rather lonely environments. You can imagine if you're on a street or if you're on a complex of building which are five floors and they've got a shared garden, you make friends with your neighbours, you see your neighbours. I mean, I live in a six-storey building. I know everybody in that building because I constantly see them in the lift. When I lived in Hong Kong in a 40-storey building and I lived on the 23rd floor, I never knew anyone. I mean, how would I get to know it? It's like sort of standing in the street and saying, oh, are you the guy? You know, you never saw anyone twice. So they are lonelier. And a lot of research has been done on this. There's sort of social trust research. People, you know, I mean, academics do these mad things like leaving stamped envelopes on the 23rd floor instead of on the third floor and seeing whether anyone will post these envelopes. This is sort of a test of whether people are socially minded. And lo and behold, on the 23rd floor, people don't post the envelopes. But on the third floor, they take them down to the pillar box and send them off. So there is a sense of community in a lower-rise building, which doesn't exist in high-rise buildings. I'm not saying that high-rise buildings are automatically bad for everyone. I mean, I think for some retired people, they work quite well, especially if you've grown up around and you know people already. The people who they really don't work well for are mothers and children. Because you know, I was in the Bedminster group the day before yesterday, and there was a mother who'd lived in London, and she was on the 17th floor, and she had a baby and a 3-year-old, and she just said her life was really difficult because the 3-year-old wanted to go down to the street and play, and the baby was always, you know, it was a very difficult to manage situation. And I think that's true of a lot of with young mothers. Now, in Bedminster, Nicola Beach has come in and stopped a tall building, which was going to be a student building, largely students. And I understand the reasons for that. Some areas of Bristol have got many too many students. Where I live, at the top of St. Michael's Hill, you could argue that's the case. But that means you're going to get young people, and in 2 or 3 years, they're going to have kids. So they're stuck at the top in 1 or 2 floor flats. It's very difficult for them to cope. No social life. You know, I don't think
Marvin Rees will say one thing to you, Matthew, yeah. And that is we need to build as many and as quick as we can.
Yeah, the reality is it's not a solution for the housing crisis.
I mean, he's obviously gone to the developers and said, yeah, how can I build as many houses as quickly
as
possible?
That's obviously true. But the houses that he's going to get built, you have to understand that high-rise buildings are, on the whole, more expensive. If you build really high, they're almost 50% more expensive.
Well, they're more expensive to build that building, but per unit... Surely not so expensive.
No, they're more expensive per unit because you've got the sort of central structure and central staircase. The whole thing needs to have more in it.
What Marvin will be saying is, yeah, my friends, the developers, have told me that high rise is going to be good because we can build more houses like that and house Bristol's people. There's something like 15,000 people waiting to get housed in the city.
Well, I wonder if his friends, the developers, have told him how much the units are going to cost, because they will be more expensive to build because high-rise buildings do cost more to build. And you're likely to be housing people who can afford £500,000 type flats.
But hang on, the land you buy is one of the most expensive things to build,
yeah,
when
true.
It comes to buying somewhere.
Yeah.
If you're only building 1 or 2 stories on that, surely that's going to be much more expensive than building, you know, 30 stories.
That's true, but I mean, part of the reason in Bedminster why the land went up in price so much was that permission was given for a 17-storey building under George. And so all the people looking at the neighbouring plots thought, aha, we're going to get permission for high-rises. And the price of the land shot up. I mean, unfortunately, in the UK, it's the owner who captures the gain on a plan being put forward.
This is weird, isn't it? Because when the council says yes to a bit of plan, to a certain planning permission, that really is almost like printing money.
Absolutely,
it can be anyway.
Yeah. On the continent, typically, the council, the local government, can buy at pre-planning prices and enforce that. And I believe that's part of the Labour government's.
Just explain what you mean by that.
Plan. Well, they draw up the plan. And they say the price for this building, this plot of land, rather, had there been no plan, had it just been its previous state of agricultural land or whatever it was such and such, we can compulsorily purchase this land at that price. So
what's different about Britain? How does it work differently here?
Well, we have a very, very different planning system, and I'm not a planner, so I'm not very good on the details. But basically, we have a much less sort of plan-based system and much more based on an individual plot.
So the emphasis really is on the developer to say
it's all on the developer. So every time there's a building built, there's a huge quarrel. What can happen on this particular plot? Whereas typically on the continent, there's a plan.
So a developer will buy a piece of land knowing what they are and aren't allowed to build there.
Well, not necessarily. They will buy the piece of land and then they will try and wheedle extra height out of that. No, I mean.
Is that here or in the continent?
Here, yeah. I mean, if you look at, if you look at the former ambulance station on Castle Park, where we're getting 26 floors of a building, where we could have housed the same, you know, this is the fall down of the housing argument, because there was the same number of people being housed on a promised 7-floor building as will be housed on the 26-floor building. But because Marvin likes it tall and because Nicola Beach likes it tall, the developers were allowed to go to 26 floors. This is completely unnecessary and has nothing to do with housing a lot of people.
Nicola Beach, who is she and how does she fit into all of this?
I only know the name, I've only met her, but she and I've never met her. I've been on a radio station with her, but she is head of planning.
Right.
Yeah.
So, is it just you campaigning on alone at the moment, or yeah, I mean, what do you hope to achieve?
The Bristol campaign against tower blocks is basically a one-man operation, and it's me. What I hope insanely to achieve is to reverse this push towards tall buildings, because people on the whole are not keen on tower blocks, but they tend not to get agitated until there's a tower block built jolly near their own street.
So do you have any natural allies? I mean, I'm thinking of people like the Civic Society. I mean, surely they have a view on this, surely.
The Civic Society have a very strong view. They're very worried and very upset by it. And they did try and talk to Marvin, but Marvin basically refused to meet them. And Asher Craig, I think, made two appointments and turned up to neither but sent a junior. So they are being completely sidelined.
Have they been hypnotized by the developers? Well,
who, the Civic Society?
Well, no, Marvin and Asher, you know, the political leadership.
I think partly because they want to get those numbers out. And I think partly they genuinely think that tower blocks are beautiful. They really think this. I mean, Nicola Beach said to me in the interview I had 3 days ago, we're falling behind. It's terrible. We're falling behind other towns which are building all these high-rise buildings. We must hurry up.
Catch up with them, yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, look, Matthew, what's your group called and how can people follow what you're up to?
Well, it's called the Bristol Campaign Against Tower Blocks, and we have a website explaining what we do, which is bristolhighrises.com, and we have a Facebook page. I don't know how to get people to a Facebook page, but if you put in Bristol Campaign Against Tower Blocks, you will find it. And I'd really like support from people because we're going to depend on volunteers. And we need people to look a little bit more than the end of the street and consider the future of Bristol and our welfare. And actually, what I haven't talked about is our economic welfare, because we need to make Bristol a town which will attract people. And the beauty of the town is very important to attracting skilled talent and for our economic future.
Marvin has said he's going to build all over the green land around Hotwells.
Has he?
Yes. But you see, I wonder whether, again, whether this is the developers talking.
I think that would be absolutely tragic. That's such a beautiful walking and cycling area. I didn't know that, actually.
Anyway, we'll put up a link on our show page at dialectradio.co.uk to your Facebook page, your group. Matthew Montague Pollock, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, Tony, and thank you very much for having me in.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's Richie Allen. I present the Richie Allen radio show, which is an independent radio show which broadcasts in Manchester for Fab Radio here and on a few other different platforms as well. And it's just a platform for opinions about geopolitical events that are precluded from commercial and national media. Simple as that.
But the thing is, a lot of the mainstream press seems to be biased. We've been chatting to, on this programme, several people who are ex-BBC in an interview to be broadcast next week, which they were all saying that the problem is that the balance seems to have gone, that all of the coverage is one-sided. If they get somebody from the other side on, they're always somebody who's either weak or presents a very bad case. We're talking about the sort of, you know, maybe, for example, a conspiracy theorist, in big inverted commas, who believes in the moon landing. So what do you think's the problem with the mainstream press at the moment?
Tony, we've been discussing this for years. I've been lucky to know you now since the late noughties, when I began broadcasting shows like this in Spain. The media has been concentrated into the hands of smaller and smaller, decreasing amounts of people. It's owned by a handful of corporations. There is a narrative that is being, I suppose, imposed, foisted on people, for want of a better word. And you described it brilliantly there. If they want to appear to be balanced, they will invite somebody on counter to the narrative, but somebody who's weak, who isn't very well spoken, who isn't very well read. And they will put him or her up against a presenter who will continuously interrupt them, won't give them time. It's terrible, Tony, because it's anathema to what I was brought up with in commercial radio in Ireland and what you were brought up with in your time at the BBC, which is to keep your big nose out of it, keep your opinions out of it, and present to the watching or listening audience genuinely both sides of any argument. And, you know, we used to make sure that both sides were heard equally and that we didn't intervene or interject. And then you were happy that your day's work was done and that the audience got to hear an argument from two points of view. And we trusted that the audience was intellectual enough, intelligent enough to make a decision
on it. That's right. I mean, when I was at the BBC all those years ago, I was chatting to a chap that had worked and was, I think, still working for the BBC World Service. And they were actually given quite a lot more freedom than we were here in the UK, which I found quite surprising. You know, as a domestic broadcaster, you've got to toe the line more than the World Service. And he said to me, well, that's because most people around the world wouldn't believe things that were broadcast domestically. You have to give more of the truth to an international audience who are much more sceptical when it comes to towing the line of the British government. I thought that was a quite an interesting. And in fact, if you now go on to digital, which I hate to do, but you know, away from FM and onto digital, and you pick up the World Service, you'll find the actual quality of the journalism you're getting there is an enormous amount better. And also another thing he said to me was that the World Service, we really enjoy what we do because it's like the world's last court of appeal. And I think the idea of journalists as sort of being involved in a kind of justice process, you know, almost like the courts, is a very good one because, you know, what we're getting now is a bit like only hearing one of the solicitors speaking, only hearing one side of the argument before the jury. That's what the media are basically giving us. They're saying, well, the defence or the prosecution, whoever it happens to be at the time, is banned from the room, you know, so you're not going to hear the other side.
Let me ask you a question on that. How aware of that do you think the watching public are? Are they aware of it? Are they oblivious to it, Tony? What do you think?
Well, certainly, people I speak to, I think you've got a lot of people who are kind of in their comfort zone that don't want to question this stuff, which is largely the older generation, people who are maybe used to mainstream broadcasting being more balanced. Also, maybe simply because they're older, they don't have so much invested in the future. But I find the younger generation are much more questioning, and they ask basically simple questions like, with the Skripal poisoning in Salisbury, yeah, why is it that this, the most deadly nerve agent known to man, has kind of touched these three people with a kind of microgram of the stuff would kill you, and all of them seem to have survived? You know, so there's a lot of people asking these sorts of questions, and also they can see right through the lies told by Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary, who's supposed to be a credible person, about whether this is of a type developed in Russia.
He was caught out. It's very important what you're saying. He was caught out telling a lie that maybe in days of yore would have seen him forced to resign and publicly humiliated. He made statements that he was informed by people working at the chemical weapons depot near Salisbury. They told him for a fact that the agent had all the imprint of the Russians. It had the Russian fingerprints all over it. They basically contradicted him and said, well, we didn't say that at all. And yet he's still in a job. And as we're talking this evening, Yulia Skripal has emerged. It's almost like a game of poker between the British government and the Russians, who claimed that the whole thing was a hoax, it never happened. Yulia has been filmed somewhere, probably somewhere in Surrey, in London or near London. She's emerged. And strangely enough, Tony, she spoke in Russian, even though she's been here for years and speaks fluent English, and spoke in Russian and said she's fine, she's hunky-dory, my father is fine, but we won't be speaking to the Russians, or we won't be travelling to Russia anytime soon.
Well, Tony, she's been paid off. I would suggest she's just simply been paid off, just as...
Yeah, you wonder, yeah.
I mean, that's our taxpayers' money, folks. Anyway, look, one organisation, media organisation, that doesn't have the excuse of being commercial is the BBC. And we've seen an extraordinary shift in the senior staff at the BBC. What with an illness of Andrew Marr, he's had several illnesses now, but he's still one of the chief political correspondents, and he runs the flagship Marr show at the weekend for the BBC on the TV. He's been replaced by this woman called Emma Barnett. Now, Emma Barnett started, I think, around about a year or so ago on Five Live doing the breakfast show, the National Breakfast Show in the morning. She's from Woman's Hour, from the Daily Telegraph, as the former ambassador Craig Murray has pointed out, that she's extremely Tory leaning, as many of the BBC people are. Of course, in a Tory government, one of the cheats that a government can do is they can appoint all their own people to run the national broadcast, and that seems to be what they've done. But I know Emma Barnett is from Manchester, and I wonder, since you're there, I wonder if you've picked up anything about who she is and anything about her background.
Well, Tony, I have to be, all you can be in this business is honest. Until I read the Craig Murray piece, I didn't know very much about her background, except I knew she was Jewish. And I knew that because Kevin Myers, the Sunday Independent journalist who was kicked off the Sunday Independent because he made a wisecrack about Vanessa Feltz and Claudia Winkleman over the gender pay gap thing. He made a joke about, you know, because Claudia Winkleman and Vanessa Feltz are Jewish, that they weren't stupid and that they were pretty clever in negotiating their salaries. Kevin Myers was sacked, a terrific Irish writer, very famous and brilliant Irish writer. Now, Barnett did the interview with him on Radio 5 Live and made a bit of an idiot of herself. Initially in the interview, she claimed that she wasn't religious at all or had no interest in it. But when it suited her later on in the interview, she claimed to Myers that she was offended by stereotypes or by assumptions that Myers had made, or she'd claimed that he had made.
Well, I mean, this is because many people will see any kind of equating of Jews with financial impropriety and being sort of criminal cheats. That's surely racist. But the thing is that she is actually from a criminal family, which makes it, you know, a little bit more cheeky of her to criticise someone for criticising her, you know.
Now, you've been a journalist for years, and one of the things I love about you is you're decent. You're not the sort of person who kicks people when they're down. And this is not about guilt by association. You're bringing up a very important thing here, which, again, if it wasn't for Craig Murray, in fact, you tweeted the Craig Murray piece. I wouldn't have seen it if it wasn't for you. This is not about kicking Emma Barnett because her parents are criminal. It's about how this woman has been expedited through LBC, through the Telegraph, into the BBC. Now, I don't have a misogynistic bone in my body. She's an average presenter. An average, not a poor presenter by any stretch of the imagination, but an average presenter, but she's been expedited. And Craig Murray has noticed, and you followed this up, Tony, that agents or actors have been whitewashing her background, and particularly her family's background, because her parents effectively ran a brothel in this city. Both of them spent time in prison for it. But yet there are people, Tony, who don't want people or who don't want us to know about that. That's fairly concerning, I would say.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, you know, on the other side, you've got the fact that you don't want to visit the sins of the father on the son, or in this case, the mother and the father on the daughter. But having said that, it's an important part of somebody's background if they've been knowingly brought up and from a mafia family. You know, it doesn't that actually I see the whole Jewish thing as completely irrelevant. You know, it's the fact that somebody is from a criminal family and that they find it's as a result somehow much easier to make progress in the BBC. I think the thing is, for me, the state broadcaster after the Jimmy Savile scandal has got to be absolutely squeaky clean,
whiter than white.
And I think we need to see
without offending ethnic minorities. I don't mean that, but yes, it's got to be spotless.
This is, you know, the wrong sort of sends the wrong sort of message out about who it gets the grace and favour at the corporation. And also the other thing that, I mean, we're talking about quite a lot about Craig Murray this evening. I suppose maybe we should say something about who he is. He pointed out, by the way, at the weekend when the wonderful war criminal Tony Blair was given an airing on the Today programme. I think maybe it was early beginning of this week. Blair was saying that he's never sanctioned torture. He never wants anything. You know, of course, he's always been against it. Well, that's just a blatant lie that Tony Blair is telling again. But what bothers me, Richie, is that the BBC interviewers simply don't pick him up on it at all.
Why, Tony? I don't understand this. When Blair says that he wasn't complicit in torture, he had nothing to do with these Libyan people, this Libyan man being taken overseas, the blue fairy keels over with a heart attack every time Tony Blair opens his mouth. Why? I mean, to be fair to the BBC, the BBC did more than any other organisation after, post David Kelly, it must be said, post Andrew Gilligan. The BBC did more to expose Blair for his lies. So why have they gone kind of 180 degrees again and inviting him on now like he's some sort of statesman and not the filthy, murdering, torturing criminal that he is? I don't get this, Tony.
No.
Why?
No.
Is it because of Brexit? Is it because Blair is playing some part?
I think effectively, you know, it's a criminal elite that's in charge and the people at the BBC are just told they know which side their bread is buttered, and if they ask the right questions that they'll carry on in their jobs. Now, the other thing that that Craig Murray was saying was that he was involved specifically in Uzbekistan at the Foreign Office with the Foreign Secretary, I think at the time was Jack Straw and David Miliband, in exposing torture, in trying to do it within government auspices, that is to say within the civil service, within the Foreign Office, within the Cabinet Office, directly to the Prime Minister, etc., telling them that, that torture is being used in Uzbekistan, and that therefore all the intelligence that's being sent from Uzbekistan to London is unreliable. And because Craig Murray tried to do this quietly in a diplomatic way, as most diplomats do behind the scenes, and was totally ignored, he then resigned on principle. And so he knows for a fact that Tony Blair is lying when he says that he doesn't support torture.
Absolutely.
Because it was being supported then, in fact, to such an extent that they were prepared to get rid of the ambassador to Uzbekistan. He was pulled out of Uzbekistan. And Craig is a terrific, I think, source of news, because he's probably the most wonderful blogger, if I'm allowed to say that, to be almost like a fan really, on the planet, because almost every day he comes up with some massively important insight, which, to be fair, should be on Newsnight. I mean, the guy should be editing Newsnight or something, because he's coming out with all sorts of exposés of corruption, and one of them is around Wikipedia. Now, I for years and years have been very untrusting of Wikipedia, having tried to make several edits myself. One of the Freemason page, which was on the Freemasonry, which was saying, you know, the symbol of the upward facing triangle and the downward facing sort of V shape that makes the Masonic symbol, saying that here is the dividers and the ruler. Yeah, so you've got a dividers on the top and the ruler, the square rule at the bottom. And isn't it interesting how you could interpret that as divide and rule? Now, this is just really obvious from the actual picture that they had on the page. And that was immediately edited out by a certain Philip Cross.
Philip Cross, Tony, who is this guy? Well, who is this guy?
He has been doing hundreds of thousands of edits on Wikipedia every single day, and in some occasions for hours, days on end, day and night.
Full-time job, Tony. Somebody's paying him.
I would suggest that it's not just one person even. So I think we have to start looking at the checks and balances in Wikipedia. One thing I'll say before we hear what you've got to say on Wikipedia is that a couple of years ago I went to, when I was in London, I interviewed one of the Wikipedia spokespeople, and in fact it's run by something called Wikimedia, and what the guy's called, his name was Stevie Benton, told me that they were doing everything they possibly could to clear up this system. Now, someone like Philip Cross has been getting away with it for years and years. He's obviously lying. Stevie Benton, what was happening there was that government offices were being traced. It was traced back. Wikipedia vandalism and trolling was coming from the British civil service on taxpayers' money.
Wow, Tony. You know, I look at Wikipedia, Tony, and I think it's in the interest of the controlling elites to get us all into one place. That's why Facebook was invented. You know, Facebook has become the internet effectively. We're all into one place, therefore we can be controlled. It's like being kettled. And Wikipedia has become the de facto source of information for the world. That's crazy. It's funny, whenever you come on the program, on the program I present, and I love having you on, you're a real reporter, a real journalist. I sometimes get things from people, oh, thanks for having Tony Gosling on, Richie. I only get my information from Tony. Now, of course, you know how terribly wrong that is.
That sounds dangerous.
It's dreadful. And I will correct that person and say, listen, you won't meet more honest guys than Tony, but don't just get your information from Tony. Get your information from a wide variety of sources. It's important. Listen to lots of different things. See what makes sense to you. With Wikipedia, Tony, how devastating that is for investigative journalism. It is. I'm guilty. I'm totally guilty of going to Wikipedia, Tony, to find out stuff. And I'm thinking, wow, it's become the first stop, a one-stop shop for finding out stuff. We used to use libraries. We used to use different search engines and go all over the place, but now we use Wikipedia and nothing else. In other words, we've all been kettled. We are there. It is ripe for character. And by the way, thanks for what you said about Ross possibly being several people, because it's a bit foolish of me to think it was only one person if there are hundreds of thousands of edits.
Maybe we could call it. Maybe he's better off called Team Philip.
Team Philip, exactly. And Wikipedia now controls the world's historical narrative. How dangerous is that? How terrifying is that? You know, people take it as fact. If it says so on Wikipedia, it must be fact. Wow, that's incredibly.
The other thing about Philip Cross, if you look at what he's been editing, it's very specific. So you can see that 99% of what Wikipedia is telling you is correct. But on all the really important matters, so for example, the Duma alleged chemical attack, the JFK assassination conspiracy theories in big inverted commas, various things that are issues where the establishment has been lying, Philip Cross's little fingerprints are all over the place.
Amazing. And Tony, it smells like artificial intelligence.
Well, that's the way that, well, maybe, but it doesn't have to be. And I think that's the way the mainstream media works too, is that they'll tell you quite a lot of stuff which is completely 100% true, wonderful, but it's on the really key things like the weapons of mass destruction, the chemical weapons attack in Duma, that they're really lying to us a lot of the time. Anyway, look, you're based in Manchester. You've just had a big event over the last couple of days, the first anniversary of the Manchester attack, haven't you?
Yeah, the remembrance. Massive mind control, Tony. I believe anyway. I've been speaking about this for many years. I'm a student of the media and how the media works. It's, if I could ever claim to have an area of expertise, and I don't think I have any real area of expertise, but the media, broadcast media, 24-hour-a-day news channels have replaced the daily soaps. And they are running serial dramas. They are on in everybody's homes. Go into a home any afternoon, anywhere in the country, and probably muted will be one of the 24-hour news channels. They are serial dramas. They are not reporting news stories. They are not presenting facts to people. They are entertaining people. What we saw in the last couple of days in Manchester was the world's media descending to report on nothing, to report on people lighting candles, to report on people standing around crying, people who never met or never knew any of the 22 victims, God help them, heaven help them, who died.
But I mean, surely it makes sense to remember those that died.
It does make sense to remember those who died for those who knew them, Tony, for the people who knew them. We don't have enough time for this. We could spend hours on this. We're talking about the sort of grief culture that we saw in Liverpool many years ago when Ken Bigley was murdered. And ironically, the most despicable man in British politics, Boris Johnson, actually made a very good point when he talked about grief culture. It is pathos-laden mind control, where the population is being told that you have to think and you have to feel a certain way by a media that wants to think, that wants us to think that we are all in it together, when in fact the elites that are controlling things are doing everything they can to divide us. It's incredibly easy to see, but it's actually very complex what they're doing. And you saw people sitting outside the cathedral the other day in Manchester crying. Come on, Tony, give me a break. Why were they crying? You know, some of these people, most of them, in fact, outside, had nothing to do with or no relationship with anybody who
I mean, surely there is a genuine emotion there, as people want to understand why something like that would happen. The only problem, of course, is that the guy that's supposed to have done it, the alleged bomber, Salman Abedi, was reported several times to MI5 using the anti-terrorist hotline. Absolutely. Secondly, he was absolutely not in any kind of, didn't have no ability to build a bomb. So there's obviously a bomb maker that's still running around, hasn't been arrested. And there seems to me that there hasn't been no serious investigation by the authorities of what happened.
None, Tony. None. I mean, you hit the nail on the head there. Imams reported the man. Intelligence agencies in France and in Turkey said the guy was dangerous. He'd been in Syria. He was lethal. He came back to the country and a few days later, he walked into the arena at the Ariana Grande concert with a backpack with explosives and killed himself. It makes no sense whatsoever. Not to mention the fact that the British media, they have mentioned once or twice his father, Ramadan Abedi, but they've not mentioned the fact that he was paid a six-figure sum back in the mid-1990s to be part of a assassination team to kill Colonel Gaddafi. In fact, he was known to MI6 as Agent Tunworth. None of this is discussed, even though it's, you know, pretty much common knowledge, thanks to former MI5 agents like Annie Machon and David Shaler and others. And that's the point I was making, Tony, about this pathos-driven, you know, the media is trying to elicit an emotion in people. It's trying to invest an emotion in people about this stuff. Oh, let's all stand together. Let's not hate one another. Let's not hate ethnic minorities. Let's stand together. While we're doing that, and that's all fake, we're not asking, who is this guy? Who was this guy?
I mean, you could almost imagine a kind of alternative Manchester scenario where the intelligence officers responsible for allowing this guy to do what he did, Salman Abedi, not acting on the intelligence, were sort of publicly flogged. You know, this is the sort of... I mean, it's almost like back to medieval times. But look, before we wind up, I think it's always try to light a bit of a candle as well as cursing the darkness as we do. And that is looking at Wikipedia, you know, it's very, and I always do this also when having a go at Google, because Google's such a hideous creature on the internet that we all pretty much need to use, you know, is to give alternatives. And there is one, I mean, I can't vouch for it, but it's called Everypedia, Everipedia, which is an alternative to Wikipedia. You can check that out and you might just find a little bit more of a proper system to stop the likes of Philip Cross vandalising various and lying, basically using it as propaganda medium. And the other one is Search Me, which is a search engine, which is quite good. I mean, it's not quite as good as Google, but it certainly doesn't track you or anything like that. And that's SEARX.ME, which is, I mean, they basically say, look, can you please make like a £5 a year donation to us? And if not, never mind. But we are an independent search engine and we're trying to compete with Google. So I just always think we've got to try to
good stuff, Tony.
Help people find other ways of doing things rather than just pointing out all the time how dreadful our government and our big tech, big media are. Richie, I'll leave the final word to you. What are your thoughts on things like the Royal Wedding this week and whether that's something that we can be actually applauding or not?
Well, speaking to an Irishman, no, obviously not. But I thought it was wonderful. The day of the wedding was the day that Sergei Skripal was released from hospital. I don't believe in coincidences. I thought that was quite funny. There was no photographs of him, no media chasing him, asking him, was he okay? Look, I believe in patriotism. I believe in people being proud of their country. The elites don't want that. They don't want us to be nationalistic in any shape or form at all. But the royal family leaves me absolutely cold. But listen, each to his own. Thanks for inviting me on. Nobody invites me anywhere, Tony. So
well, I certainly do. And I'll also just finish by asking you to plug your website. How do people listen to your material?
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Tony. Thanks. Yeah, well, people can just go to richieallen.co.uk. There's no T in Richie. richieallen.co.uk. There's links to the live show where you hear people, not always of the calibre of Tony Gosling, but you hear people with a different take on these important events. So thanks, mate. Thanks for the opportunity.
You'll go far. If I was the BBC, you'd go far with all this media lovey stuff. Anyway, lovely to speak to you again, Richie. Take care.
Cheers, mate. Bye for now. Thanks, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
What about the whole sort of idea of pan-Arabism? That seems to be down the pan now. I mean, you've got... Actually, Saudi Arabia doesn't really seem to be an Arab country anymore. It seems to be actually closer to Israel.
That's absolutely the case. Well, you have to understand, first of all, this is extremely controversial, but I'm going to state it because you guys really spread truth on your radio station. The Al Saud clan are not really true Arabs. They are what we call Dunme. These are people who migrated from eastern Turkey, okay, after the Sabbatean messianic deviancy. They came down to Arabian Peninsula. They took on an Arabian identity, and that's when Wahhabism, by the way, spread. They're not even true Arabs. They're actually Dunme Jews. Okay? A lot of solid academic work is done on this. This is not a conspiracy theory. So it's very natural for them to come out of the closet after, 250 years or so, 300 years, and be this close to Israel. Pan-Arabism is dead, Tony. Pan-Arabism died after Kamal Nasser, who was actually brought down by the Al Saud crime syndicate. Not too long ago, a very important article that was written by Zalmay Khalilzad, who was U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan. He's an American of Afghani heritage, and then later he became the prime U.S. ambassador in Iraq, and then at some point he was the U.S. ambassador at the U.N. He wrote an article in the Politico. Basically, it was a confession by the Saudis that they have been behind every terrorist attack since the 1960s, including bringing down this whole concept of secular Arab nationalism and pan-Arabism, because they saw that as a clear and present danger to the backward-minded Wahhabist misinterpretation of Islam, which is their interpretation.
Now, actually, does that include 9/11?
Yeah, it's very complicated with 9/11. Extremely, extremely complicated.
Well, give us your in a nutshell version.
To simplify it would be, I will give you my nutshell version, but to simplify it would be what the infiltrators in the 9/11 truth movement are doing. The Saudis are very involved. The Israelis are very involved. The Russians, the governments of the world are extremely well informed, and they are not cashing that chip in. if the time comes where we have a serious threat of war between Russia and United States, then the Russian intelligence services will reveal what exactly happened there. I do talk to them frequently, and I say, what are you guys waiting for? Are you waiting for a, you know, mushroom cloud in one of the cities in the Middle East? You got to reveal that information. The more 9/11 conspiracy is not talked about at a serious academic and at the legal level, the more they're going to create these white helmet operations, these false chemical attacks, because they set a terrible precedent with 9/11, and they're going to continue that. This will continue. I don't know if you recall, a couple of weeks ago or 10 days ago, there was a ridiculous $6 billion lawsuit in New York, and we know who the lawyers are and who's, you know, backing them up, that the Iranians were behind 9/11. I mean, the level of idiocy has gone to that much. It's, of course, all psychological propaganda for domestic purposes in order to manufacture consent to go to war with Iran.
What do you think that the Russians, etc., know that aren't telling us about 9/11?
No, they know exactly,
I mean, the thing
exactly
is, I mean, it is such an important event because it led to this whole sort of so-called war on terror, which meant that NATO countries were really stomping around all over the world, just deciding to invade who they wanted to.
Yes, and you don't need to go far. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Read the documents that were published by PNAC, Project for the New American Century, John Bolton, Cheney, a lot of these neocons practically give it away why 9/11 had to happen, for the same reasons that Pearl Harbor had to happen. And we all know Pearl Harbor was a way to goad the American people to go to, you know, go to war against Japan and the European countries. So it's, they're playing the same card, and they have been getting away with it for so long. I mean, we can go to the sinking of Lusitania. We can go down to the Bay of Pigs. You know, there's quite a few precedents for this kind of behavior, except that 9/11 changed history for perhaps decades to come. And the more they set these precedents, the more we are far away from the truth and actually prosecuting these people.
So I'm going to ask you to answer your own question, because you've been saying to the Russians, etc., why won't you get this out into the public domain? Because all the time you're not doing that, there is more and more terrorist attacks taking place. So what do you think really happened on 9/11?
I have written 6 books on this topic, among other related topics, and it's all published anonymously. I had to. I cannot take any credit for my academic work, because that, when you really talk about 9/11, your life could be in danger. I mean, really talk about it academically and legally, with clear documentation. Everybody else who's talking about this openly, you know, Alex Jones, these kind of blowhards, you know, they are only touching the tip of the iceberg. Whereas people like us, we go into exactly what's beneath the iceberg.
So are you going to blow your cover now and tell us the title of one of the books so we can read it?
Yeah, right. Of course not. I wrote some of those books 10 years ago. The last one I wrote was 4 years ago.
Okay, so can you just at least give us one or two points that maybe people haven't heard about the September the 11th attacks that we need to know?
Yeah, well, that would give me away now, wouldn't it? But the information is out there if you want to go to these books and find out what's really going on. I can tell you this just a little bit, that I collaborated heavily with a 9/11 researcher, a true man of integrity named Michael Rubert. He was an ex-NARC LAPD officer, and he exposed what's going on at the CIA. And he gave one of the best speeches about what was really behind 9/11 at Oregon State University, literally 2 months after that horrible event in Washington and New York.
So what did Mike say? If you can't tell us what you say, what did he say?
Unfortunately, Michael Rupert is no longer with us. Just type his name on the internet. He wrote this amazing book called Crossing the Rubicon. I'm sure your audience is aware with what that means, going back to Roman times. Rubicon was the point of no return for the Roman soldiers, and that's what his book was called. He also had a very interesting website called Into the Wilderness, as in Christ going into the wilderness to purify himself. This was a deeply spiritual man of integrity. He blew the cover off of CIA's importing of drugs into the ghettos in the United States, into inner city, and the whole thing with crack.
That That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Bristol Campaign Against High Rises journalist Matthew Montague Pollock, also to Richie Allen and to Professor Alexander Azadgan, talking about 9/11 there, and he's based in California. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. I'll be back on Friday with a politics show live from 6 till 8, but that was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
I think they could do awfully well. That's Bess from the Secret Vampire soundtrack EP from Chemical Underground, a Teen C Power.